My name's Robin Burgess. I'm a professor here at the London School of Economics and director of the International Growth Centre. And you can see I'm actually inside my LSE office. So this is, today we are very pleased to have Partho Shoem presenting his book on taxation, history, theory, law and administration. And for many of you in the room, you'll know that Partho has been a bit of a giant within the area, not only of Indian taxation, but taxation around the world. And it's good to see people like Vito Tanzi in the room and many others who have worked in that area. I'll start by saying that if you want to have captioning appearing, you just need to pin the interpreting matters, and that will give you a caption for the talking that's going on. But let me just introduce Partho and then his discussion. So I guess early on in my career, I worked with Nick Stern on taxation in India, actually, before I did my PhD and got to know Partho then. I think what's special about Partho is that he sort of has taken, and it's very present in the book, a sort of an overall view of taxation. You know, typically it's taught in very different ways, it's split up. He's currently the chairman of the International Tax Research and Analysis Foundation in India, and is visiting the LSE International Inequalities Institute. So we're very pleased to have him present the book today. He's also received Brazil's highest civilian honor, the commander of the Order of the Southern Cross, for his work on Brazilian fiscal reform. And where I saw him and in subsequent years, was as an advisor to the finance ministry and in various positions in India. So that's his background. I think what's special about the book is it sort of is kind of bringing together a lot of the work he's done over his career, not just in India, but around the world. So we're very pleased to have Partho present the book. His discussant today will be Ricardo Guerrero Fernandez, who's a PhD student at King's College. And what we'll be doing today is we will have Partho present, then have the discussant, and then we will, I'll say a few words, and then we will open it up to the to discussion at the end. We plan to finish at 2:15 UK time. And I think what I would advise, it's entirely up to you, is that if people could remain muted, but perhaps to make it a bit more personable to keep videos on. And then at the end, what we'll do is if you wish to ask question, you just need to use your raise hand feature, and we'll have about a quarter of an hour at the end for people to raise hands and to ask, you know, to unmute and ask questions. I think that would be the format that would work best. And then I think the final thing to say is the next event of the Inequalities Institute is on inequality in the and the differentiation of capital, the scientific project of political economy. So that will take place on the 18th, Thursday the 18th, and you'll be sent a link for that. So I think it's time for me to hand over to Partho. Partho, take it away. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin. I hope everyone can hear me. To begin, I must say I appreciate Professor Francisco Ferreira's invitation and the support of so many at III in organizing this public event to present my new book on taxation. And to Professor Robin Burgess and Ricardo Guerrero for agreeing to be on the panel. Also, I must thank many participants who are present today. And I see Vito Tanzi, my mentor and friend for many years. So, and there are others, I didn't even see the pictures yet. Thank you so very much for this big presence for my talk. And I hope, do some justice to my talk. Reflecting its 500 pages or more, there are actually many strands flowing through the book. Therefore, I have selected one strand, that of equity and justice in taxation, on which I will focus today, And I hope I can do justice to the talk. I understand there are many non-economists among the participants, and I've tried to keep that in my mind, in the thrust of my talk. But as many of you non-economists know, economists are terribly biased and narrow-minded. I'll try my very best to move a little ahead from that. Traveling half a century back to 1973, I wrote a master's thesis which I called Non-Ethical Distribution and the Failure of Markets. Thankfully, the University of Rochester accepted it. What had bothered me was Pareto's optimality criterion that, irrespective of initial endowments of economic agents or the wealth they possessed in a society, if one person gained without anyone else losing in the transaction, then that change must be optimal for that society. I always found that to be strange. Thus today, if tax policy can keep the poor exactly in their position without any deterioration, the escalation of millionaires into billionaires and billionaires into trillionaires, as is happening today through tax incentives, tax sparing, tax holiday, accelerated depreciation of assets, zero tax on landed wealth and on inheritance, would be just fine. This is the basis of market economics as I see it. So all this time, for half a century through thick and thin, I have been pondering this peculiar adage as I immersed myself in taxation. And my search became one for any evidence of equity and justice in taxation. A word on history. Throughout its history, taxation, in my observation, has been an extractive instrument. Extractive because it is not linked to any one-on-one assured return. An instrument because it has been a tool in the hands of the powerful. Conquerors, even in the past century, and the upper castes, slave owners, religious majority in past eras, and policymakers in the present, who make tax laws that, on balance, would not only protect, but advance their interests that assuredly increases inequality. Tax could not be farther from a social contract between government and the governed that we learn and teach to students on a regular basis. In my book, I used India's tax history as a case study because we have always learned Western taxation history as we grew up. I found some good fiscal advice in the ancient text of Mahabharata, reputed to be the longest worded volume among written epics. But when one comes down to recorded history, one begins to find evidence of tax pressure. For example, of tax revolts under the majestic southern kingdom of Vijayanagara in the 15th century, while Krishnadeva Raya, the ruler, was espousing progressive taxation, inscriptions reveal that the tax collectors or adhikarigal put the collection of a poll tax to competitive bidding, leading to such distress among farmers that it ended up in a tax revolt. Coming down to the Mughals, the dynasty that followed all the Brahmanical kingdoms and ruled over most of northern India between 1562 and 1862 for 300 years, administered primarily land-based taxation in an organized fashion, with tax rates reflecting fertility of soil, land area, contiguity to urban areas, and so on, especially under Akbar the Great, the third Mughal. Akbar also abolished the jizya, which was a progressive income tax on non-Muslims imposed by earlier Mughals. But Aurangzeb, the sixth Mughal, reimposed it, thereby acquiring no small degree of notoriety and having left a bad taste in Indian taxation history. By the time the Mughals were finished, the British had taken over. The rule and reign during that period are covered in two chapters of the book. Suffice it to say that the extremities imposed were at least as grave as policies used by other colonial powers of that era. It is tough to judge how they emanated in their minds or were applied as policy by the top layers of a society on another people, except to conclude that commercial interests can have no limits. Let me take a quick dip into taxation theory. The diagram here, I call the cave painting of taxation on partial incidents, the very first perhaps that economists learn and teach. It talks of a tax on the supply, therefore supplier, that is the curve S, which shows as prices go up, the supplier supplies more of a product, say laptop, as is shown there. The supply curve of laptop shifts left from S to ST, and the equilibrium price moves from E8 to E9. Sorry, they are named E8, E9, etc., because they're in a continuation of the figures that appear in the book. At E9, the equilibrium price increases, as you can see. Yet the consumer can buy less laptop because the position of E9 is at higher price and lower laptop. Isn't it odd? It reflects human reaction to exogenous changes imposed on a person from external forces. And one can feel how she, the supplier, must feel when a tax is suddenly imposed on her. It is this reaction and its effects that are called distortionary, causing inefficiencies in the resource allocation or the efficiency effect of the tax. I'll come to the resources behind laptop just now. After all, the student is taught that the tax is on the supplier, but the supplier successfully passes on part of the tax burden to the consumer. And the analysis is called partial incidence because it ignores how the returns to the factors of production or resources, such as capital, labor, and land, are affected as a result of the tax. Once the factors of production or resources are included in the story, that account becomes one of general incidence, and the fallout can go in any which direction from the original market equilibrium. While economists at one stage tended to worry about this effect, tax professionals from other fields, accountants, administrators, lawyers, view it askance or not at all. That is, what are the ramifications or the fallout effects of a tax on one person, one economic person, on all the other economic persons in an economy? Today, it has probably gone out of vogue even among economists. I mentioned my concern over general tax incidence on unintended victims when the effect of a tax works out through time and through the economy to a finance minister with whom I worked for several years. He smiled and responded, "Partho, in the long run, we are all dead." My book attempts to bring various tax-related concerns to all professions under one umbrella to lay before them how the ramifications of tax can spread in different ways that sometimes escape consideration or stay ignored. It is my hope that students of taxation will have the opportunity to look at all these aspects as they learn taxation in the future years. A theoretical principle of taxation, as is being shown in the slide now, is horizontal and vertical equity. This is also a little bit peculiar in the following sense, despite the best of intentions. Horizontal inequity says that economic agents equally placed prior to the imposition of a tax may find themselves to be unequally affected by the tax. Vertical inequity says that a tax may exacerbate the inequity that already exists in the income distribution in the economy, or that a tax may worsen income distribution. The equity principle, therefore, says that a tax should eschew horizontal inequity and vertical inequity. I don't know of any tax that has actually achieved this. The income tax had attempted it through a progressive tax structure to reflect higher ability to pay as incomes rise, but in practice has moved away from that due to tax reductions and incentives enjoyed mainly by upper income groups. The efficiency principle, as I already indicated, recommends minimizing economic distortions that a tax can cause, since the tax forces consumers to alter their preferences to consume, as we saw in the cave painting diagram, and the producers also to change their resource allocation and produce a different amount of their commodity than they originally did. Optimal taxation is another phrase that puts the minimization of these such distortions from a tax in a prime position, thus moving away from equity. It simply asks equity to be addressed through the expenditure side of the government budget by including expenditures aimed at low income groups. This does not solve the problem necessarily. As far back as 1982, Julian Legrand of LSE, in his Strategy of Equality, a lovely little book, showed how UK's public expenditure in housing, transport, health, and education actually ended up helping the rich over the poorer, despite the objective of the Attlee plan having been just the opposite. This was a major transfer program in effect for public sector works in various sectors. But as Julian Legrand showed, the objective was really not realized. Indeed, Keith Joseph and Jonathan Sumption of Oxford had already concluded in 1979 in their book Equality that the function of the state in the UK had been, to quote, traditionally used to justify the redistribution not only in favor of the poor, not in favor of the poor, but in favor of the rich and powerful, end quote. That is from their page one. Admittedly, progressive tax structures also possess some dangers. Note that inflation can raise nominal incomes, which are set in pounds or dollars, even when real incomes remain the same. Therefore, when there is inflation and nominal incomes rise, taxpayers can be dragged up to a higher tax bracket, which are set in nominal terms usually. And they pay more tax, though their real incomes have not changed. Thus, progressivity is not a panacea for addressing equity in all circumstances. Let me examine a few prevalent tax practices as we find them in the world today. Too much progressivity is argued to cause tax evasion or flight of capital or of professional labor across a country's borders and therefore escape taxation. Therefore, countries have moved away from it. Thus, equity is not straightforward to achieve. Here, my question remains as to what is a huge bureaucracy of tax administration set up in all countries that causes the exchequer a huge amount of national resources doing if they are not able to track down tax evasion and tax avoidance without, however, employing tax terrorism, as some administrators have been accused of doing. Here we must think and reflect as tax administrators of optimizing the use of tax administration resources beyond being bureaucracies that really are not serving the social purpose. This is often a case of the question of justice between the state and taxpayer. Since comprehensive income is difficult to design, countries use property taxes, non-wage taxes, surcharges or surtax, that is a tax on the super rich, or minimum income taxes. But many of these have also receded or disappeared in recent years. And for arguments such as tax evasion, cannot be administered and so on and so forth, while in the 1960s and 70s, they were still in vogue. Let us take another example, that of capital. When there are returns to capital or income being earned from capital, they are dividends. When the value of capital increases, they are capital gains. There is no reason why dividends or capital gains should be taxed less than ordinary income from salaries or interest is taxed. But indeed, they are taxed less in most countries in the guise of special considerations. Equity considerations become irrelevant here. But the bottom line is that dividends and capital gains are basically earned by the rich and wealthy in every country. The corporate income tax is a tax on the income generated by corporations. But such income is so protected under special regimes, such as special economic zones, preferred or promoted sectors, and so on, that its effective rate becomes very low compared to what is called the headline or formal or legal rate. The same government that gave the incentives in the first place can then go into reverse gear and impose a minimum tax on them. Minimum alternate tax in India, Latin America, and alternate minimum tax in United States, Canada, and others. By definition, if the general CIT, I'm using that for the corporate income tax rate, is reduced, the expected tax revenue from it, from MAT, should decline, or the expected tax revenue from CIT should decline. So as a result, the MAT, which is a minimum tax on corporations, should also decline, because the MAT simply reflects the collectibility of the corporate tax and its rate. But often the reverse is the case. When the CIT rate declines, the MAT seems to rise, as if the government is giving a low CIT rate upfront, but is making up for it in a backhanded manner through the MAT. This is the case, again, of the state working in opposition to the private business sector and is clearly unjust and inequitable between the taxpayer and the state. Here I show a simple graphical depiction of the way the CIT and the MAT have moved in India. When it was introduced in 1988-89, for about 4 years, the MAT and the CIT, as you can see, moved in the same direction, in the same downward direction. But then from 1992-93, as the corporation income tax was further reduced, the MAT started increasing. Only in the last few years, from 1918 onwards, you see them moving in parallel. Therefore, my point is that they were moving in the wrong direction most of the years. And this simple regression that shows that the independent variable that determines the MAT rate is minus with respect to corporate income tax rate. It is about one third of minus 0.32, showing that the relationship between the two is negative, and one third of the MAT's movement over the years is explained by that of the CIT, but in the wrong direction. State, as opposed to the taxpayer, is what I'm talking about now, and which shows that inequity also exists in taxation between the state and the taxpayer. This one example is that of retrospective taxation. Retrospective taxation is one which makes it impossible to perform for a business because tax may be demanded in the future that cannot be anticipated or planned for at present. A business decides, I'm reading from the fourth bullet here, a business decides to invest in your T, say, taking into account its risk preferences, it has made that decision. 5 years later, in year T.5, 5 years after the investment is made and the beginning of operations, the government declares that the tax has now been changed, but that it will be applied from 10 years prior to the present day or from T minus 5. Then the risk basis of the original investment crumbles and the business enters into a realm of uncertainty, making it impossible to perform. Often the value-added tax or the goods and services tax are eulogized. Yes, they are easy to collect and easy to administer and gives steady revenue to the exchequer. But they are terribly regressive in actuality because simply consumption forms a larger portion of a poor householder's budget. But there is no country that thinks about the extent of inequity that this tax wreaks. Another type of inequity wrought by unwillingness to tax is intergenerational inequity, which is very important today. Degradation of the environment is causing climate change on a massive scale. Yet a global carbon tax has been opposed internationally, despite the fact that it would comprise an instrument favoring a non-pecuniary transfer to future generations in the form of better control of carbon emissions and its associated environmental degradation. Instead, we continue to rob from the future to overconsume in the present. And perhaps this battle is almost lost. Coming to taxes on international trade, I find terrible inequities there. On the one hand, developing countries have been pressured to lower customs duties to say that it is more competitive, while advanced economies have continued to impose non-tax barriers on developing countries under several disguises, such as environmental degradation, child labor, and so on, as if they themselves do not suffer from any of these conditions. Observing its trajectory, I have concluded that it is economically driven for fear of competition. Not only equity, but perhaps to a certain degree, honesty goes down the drain here. Now I come to this very emerging area of international taxation of multinational enterprises who have been avoiding tax payment throughout the world. Possibly historically, the most egregious equity among nations has been the advanced countries adopting the residence principle. That is, where capital is owned or resides, as opposed to the source principle, that is where the source of income from the use of that capital takes place. So, according to this principle, it is where capital is owned or resides that tax should accrue. or revenue should accrue, not where the capital is utilized and production takes place. For more than centuries, the residence countries were the colonists and the source countries were mainly the colonized. Thus, though incomes generated from capital occurred in the colonies, no tax revenue or very little tax revenue accrued to them. This was just another aspect of the ramifications of colonial policy globally, recently being studied intensively by Professors Bhambra of Sussex University, Reddy of the New School of Social Research in New York, Wilkerson of Harvard, who's now in the US administration, and others. Not too surprisingly, the same basis of international taxation continues for another 70 years in the post-Second World War era. Only after the 2008 global financial and economic crisis, advanced economies perceived possible benefits accruing to them from applying the source principle and began conceding the advantages of that principle. And the M&E tax base erosion and profit shifting or BEPS project was born, that together countries attempted to bring M&E taxation on the forefront and find ways to be able to successfully tax them. Nevertheless, the US remains basically opposed to the source principle. Not unsurprisingly, US technocrats have offered explanations as to why the US effectively already incorporates a source principle in its taxation. If so, why the US cannot accept its formalization remains a mystery. The US's continuing opposition to the taxation of the digital economy proves this point. Indeed, it is taking action against countries that have taken unilateral action, such as France, Italy, India, and others, even as multinational digital and services companies escape taxation, paying as low as 0.5% of their global incomes as tax revenue globally, all because their headquarters are in the US mainly, revealing once again little concern regarding international equity. With 136 countries supporting the move, the only aspect that the US has acceded to is a global minimum corporate tax rate of 15% that will apply to M&Es over a threshold of euro 750 million. But such a high threshold may not yield much revenue for emerging economies, since not too many multinational enterprises operating there are likely to be that large. However, there is a clause in this overall package that countries will be able to apply an income inclusion rule to M&Es headquartered in their country, even if they do not meet the threshold. How exactly this clause will be actually structured for implementation is not clear yet. If it all works out, some $100 billion of profits have been claimed to be transferred for taxation in source countries, that is, where the profits are earned from countries where the capital is owned or resides. So if it works, it will certainly be a success story. So this is the 15% minimum tax that the world is expecting from US President Biden's accession to international taxation. In any event, the US president may not be fully successful because he is lacking support from top Republicans. For example, the top Republican in the House Ways and Means Committee of the US Congress, who has described all this as dangerous economic surrender that sends US jobs overseas, undermines our economy, and strips away our US tax base. It is once again, I must say, the US for itself and farthest lies any considerations of international equity. Let me sum up. Equity is difficult to encounter in taxation history, taxation theory, among commonly prevalent taxes in the world, or in policies being proposed in the context of intergenerational equity, as in the environment taxes. The individual income tax, the corporate income tax, and international trade taxes such as customs duties also suffer the same absence or lack. And most recently, tax avoidance by multinational enterprises that is often protected by home countries where they are headquartered, that in addition operate tax havens to hide them, have caused havoc in equity in international taxation. Thank you very much, and thanks for your patience.
Thank you very much, Parthos. I think we'll now pass to Ricardo for some discussants' comments, and then you'll have your opportunity after that to ask questions. So Ricardo, do you want to kick off, please?
Thank you, Robin. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to our friends in different latitudes. First, I want to thank Professor Shom for the invitation to give my comments on your fascinating book and fantastic presentation today. And I want to start my comments quoting a paragraph. Of one of the multiple working papers of Vito Tanzi that is here in the room when he was working at the IMF. In this working paper, he comments about the relationship between optimal tax theory, tax design, and the art of the possible in tax reforms in the developing world. I quote, "In developing countries, tax policy is often the art of the possible rather than the pursuit of the optimal. It is therefore not surprising that economic theory and especially optimal taxation literature have had relatively little impact on the design of tax systems in these countries. Although the theoretical grounds of taxation can find difficult application when reforming tax systems, we should recognize the crucial synergy between ideas, principles of taxation, and the tax reforms enacted by countries for fostering either efficiency or vertical equity in tax systems. This argument is very well developed in Professor Shom's book, and I will concentrate my comments in this relationship. Professor Shom's book highlights the importance for tax experts and tax policymakers of all fields, economists, lawyers, accountants, of having an overall understanding of the tax phenomena. His book develops the argument that tax codes result from the interaction of ideas, rules, institutions, and actors during time. That the tax system is not only an output in which one or two variables intervene. A reader of Professor Shom's book would agree that the tax system is the result of a policymaking process that comprehends at least three main topics. First, the design of tax rules, where the economic theory and principles of taxation are fundamental. Second, the drafting and discussion of tax legislation, where the constitutional and legal framework configures the rules of the game. And third, the enforcement of tax law, where the administrative setup and the judiciary play a crucial role in guaranteeing the rule of law. The first part of Professor Shom's book explains and develops the principles or ideological setup of tax systems, where the trade-off of efficiency and equity is defined. Analyzing the fundamental theory of taxation in this area is important for understanding the pendulum evolution between efficiency and vertical equity of tax reforms in the world during the last 70 years. In the case of Latin America and other developing countries, scholars identify the period between 1940 and 1970 as a moment where tax reform were focused on vertical equity. A second period between the 80s and 2000s with a focus on efficiency as a result of Washington consensus reforms. Finally, the third period of a return of vertical equity and progressivity in the tax systems. One can also argue that this period started in the developed world in the mid-2010s and is gaining force after COVID. Therefore, contrary to the critiques of the optimal tax theory framework, some scholars, and one can include Professor Shom in this group, would consider that understanding the basics of the efficiency and equity trade-offs is crucial for analyzing the path of the reforms in different countries and why some reforms obtain the desired results while others do not. When we explore and dig within the concept of equity and particularly vertical equity, we should agree with Professor Shom's critique of the rudimentary theory behind this idea. The above is more important when we consider that some scholars, policymakers, and international institutions have focused their efforts on analyzing the efficiency part of the trade-off, almost ignoring what is happening with equity. Quoting Professor Shom's presentation, the results of tax reforms set aside any supremacy of the ability to pay principle of taxation, that is, of vertical equity among taxpayers. Distributional considerations are attempted to be resolved through the expenditure side of the government budget rather than taxation. For instance, when discussing about income taxes, Professor Shom argues that some countries have moved away from progressivity, decreasing their top tax rates in the last decades, justifying the above, indicating that lower tax rates on capital encourage investment and savings, saying little with respect to what is happening with vertical equity. Moreover, it has been stated that high rates increase evasion and avoidance and put more challenges for tax administrations. Notwithstanding the critiques to the lack of development of vertical equity, some scholars, particularly Emmanuel Saez, Thomas Piketty, Gabriel Zucman, and others, have been given a ray of hope, reviving the importance of vertical equity within the last 20 years. As they show, the argument that high rates increase evasion and avoidance and diminish investment and savings needs to distinguish between the artificial and real behavioral responses to taxes when analyzing the elasticity of taxable income. As shown by empirical evidence of recent years, particularly from Scandinavian countries, the elasticity of taxable income is lower than previously thought. Moreover, the behavioral responses to taxes depend heavily on how countries provide more tools to their tax administrations to tackle artificial responses to higher taxation in the form of avoidance and evasion. As Professor Shom argues when discussing the enforcement of tax law, the tax administration role should be seeking ways to lower the artificial responses of taxpayers. The complexity of tax systems should not be an excuse for fostering more vertical equity in tax systems. Therefore, one can conclude that the theory and empirical evidence of the last years of research promote the necessity of advancing towards more vertical equity in tax reforms. The above goes in line with what we have seen in Professor Shom's presentation. Now, how do you explain ideological and empirical aspects of tax design are related to the policymaking process? After discussing the principles of taxation, Professor Shom's book discusses the challenges that governments and tax administrations face when trying to put the principles of taxation into practice. First, he identifies the challenges in designing the tax system. Second, the challenges when drafting the tax legislation. And third, challenges when implementing and enforcing what has been approved. Professor Shom observes that this is more complex when some governments use tax policy as a political weapon. Professor Shom says that governments, particularly in the developing world, introduce new legislation almost as a stamp of its existence, which may transform the reality of tax law as a subject to the ideological bent of a prevailing regime. Taxation is then a complex political phenomenon where the ideological and principled questions have to live together with rules of the policymaking process and the incentives that the game provides to political actors, including the private sector. Let's take an example. The bargaining between the parliament and executive about the characteristics of a specific or general anti-avoidance provision depends on the constitutional principles of taxation, their legal interpretation, in how the judiciary has considered tax avoidance as a formalistic or substantive phenomenon of tax law, etc. Moreover, it also includes the extent of the private sector's lobby. The legislative backgain also includes how the tax administration respects the rule of law. As it is well developed in Professor Shom's book, there are different aspects playing a role when drafting and enacting tax legislation. Therefore, when claiming for more equity in tax systems, either national or international tax equity, and after analyzing Professor Shom's claims concerning the policymaking process of tax legislation, one can raise several questions that need more answers from scholars. To what extent do the policymaking process and the rules of the game foster agreements of players towards having more vertical equity tax reforms? Is the constitutional and legal setup prone to incorporate new rules or change the existing setup considering the ability to pay to achieve progressivity? What is happening with the informal behavior of the executive, the legislative, and the tax administration? What is the role of the private sector when these rules are discussed and executed? The Pandora Papers and other scandals of the last years have shown that the vertical equity of national and international tax system is broken. However, the COVID economic and social crisis should be seen as an opportunity for scholars, policymakers, and international organizations to promote an agenda that aims to foster vertical equity of tax systems. Professor Shom's theoretical and practical framework on tax theory, tax policy making, and tax design are important for understanding how we can design and promote tax systems that foster the ability to pay principle. Revisiting the economic debates of optimal taxation theory and understanding each country's policymaking context will be crucial for improving the progressivity of tax systems overall. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. Carthur just asked me to say a couple of things before we open up. So let me just pick up on two things really. So the first is my involvement with taxation in India was when Manmohan Singh was the finance minister and myself and Nick Stern were there working on excise taxes, which were on the sort of central side, and sales taxes, which were on the state side. And the idea was to come up with a VAT. And so what was interesting, we wrote a review piece in the Journal of Economic Literature back in the early 90s, is at that time, it was a much cruder world. We were trying to get rid of trade taxes in order to kind of introduce things like sales taxes, VAT. But the world has really moved on from that, both in the terms of the observability of income and, you know, of various types. So as Parthur was sort of pointing out, and Ricardo as well, the issue now is really one where it's not impossible to observe capital, income, and so forth. It's a question of whether you're willing to tax it. And I think I've just come back from COP26 in Glasgow, and I guess two things jumped out at me. The first is that there's now, kind of following on Partho's work, quite a large body of literature that is focusing on two things. One is taxation of the rich, and how does one go about that? And we have people like Daniel Rack and Camille Lande and Anna Spinawin here in the LSE working on that very much with the Inequality Institute. So that's an exciting area because people are at least trying to do something and experimenting with how one does that. But the other area that Partho focused upon a lot is international taxation. So this is the taxation of multinationals, the ability to hide your income in various other jurisdictions and so forth. And when I was hearing Partho talk and Ricardo, I did feel that the two are kind of related in the following sense. So when I was up in Glasgow, there was protests everywhere, as one would imagine. The young were protesting that they felt shortchanged by what we've done. And it made me think about two things. One is essentially that in a world where it's felt that the rich are not paying their dues, there is a kind of breaking down of the social contract. So people feel like, why should I pay my taxes if, you know, the very rich are not paying their taxes? And of course, the very rich are then linked to multinationals often. So you have this kind of combined problem where the poor feel, or the people who are at the kind of bottom end of the income distribution feel, agreed, correctly so, that neither the rich are paying nor the multinationals that are making a lot of the income. So if I go back and think about sort of the time of Manmohan Singh and the early 90s in India, there was a kind of understanding that there wasn't going to be a great deal of progressivity. However, India had enormous revenue needs to fund development of various types, infrastructure, education, health, and so forth. And so that was accepted, that you had a not very progressive tax base, but none the one that had to expand to fund these new expenditures. But I think in the modern world, the kind of concentration of wealth, particularly capital, amongst very few people and very few companies is really sort of breaking apart the social contract, in the sense that we now sense in the world a great deal of grievance about what is people not paying their dues, not paying for the roads that we all drive on, the services that we receive, the NHS and so forth in this country. So I think that is a sort of a fundamental problem. The two things of international taxation and taxation of the rich are very linked, because they affect the social contract and people's willingness to pay for taxes. And I think that's particularly strong in the environmental area, because there you not only have the problem that the young feel that the rich and the developed countries have created this problem, but there's a big international aspect to it, in the sense that a lot of the work I've done on India really shows that the effects of rising temperatures, A, are much bigger in the countryside than they are in cities, but they're much bigger in India than they are in the US. But the US has produced much of this greenhouse gases. So how are we going to think about, never mind the distribution of growth, which is sort of what traditional development economics has been about, the distribution of externalities from growth and the effects of that, I think is a big issue of how one compensates the countries that are going to be most affected by environmental damage, which is principally the poorer countries that didn't produce the externalities. So I think that's the kind of a follow-on that I kept thinking about when Partho was talking. And then I guess the final thing is that it is exciting to see so many young people working on taxes again, in part because there is such a concern, as Ricardo was saying, about how broken many of these systems are. But I think when I talk to people like Tim Besley, who worked a lot on state capacity, it does feel like you have to bring in, as Partho has done, a lot of these issues around values, around politics, to understand how are we going to get people willing to kind of contribute to the national revenues. Because of course, those are going to be needed more than ever in the kind of build out from COVID. The final thing I'd like to say is I spent much of the COVID period on Zoom talking to people in India, you know, Pakistan, Uganda, about how to deal with COVID. And I think one thing that COVID has done is at least place some emphasis back on redistribution and the need for, because of course there was an immediate need and states responded in different ways. And so I think that, as Ricardo was saying, that might be an opportunity to begin to think about how one thinks of new tax instruments that might be able to achieve a little bit more of that. But I think I'll stop there. So what we should do now is, if you'd like to ask a question, I suggest you raise your hand, and if you want to say who you are and then ask the question, that would be probably the best way. So anybody who wants to, or indeed, if you just want to unmute and ask a question, we're probably a small enough group to do that. But who would like to start? Vito. I think you have to unmute, Vito.
No.
You're still muted, sorry.
Yes. Okay now?
Here we go. Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay, maybe being the oldest person in the room, I have the privilege of starting. Also, I have the privilege of being a friend of Bartó. I've known him now forever, probably longer than he wants me to admit. Otherwise, would reveal his age too. And I'm really a great admirer of his work and what he has been doing all this time. But the presentation today was fascinating to me for two reasons. One, I have a book coming out with the Cambridge University Press on the environment. And so it will be coming out in the next 4 or 5 months. So I hope that you will find of some interest. But the other on the issue of equity and efficiency. You know, I was drawn by very strange circumstances to write a paper on growth and taxation. You know, the paper now is making the tour of publications. And I read a lot of stuff connected with the growth and taxation. And what struck me was the enormous amount of time that people, economists, have allocated to efficiency and how little they have essentially allocated to equity. And, you know, when I try to sort out much writing on the topic, the conclusion I read, especially some of the work coming from the OECD, various papers coming out from the OECD on this theme, there are two basic conclusions that, you know, taxes should be specially levied on property, personal property, you know, housing and so forth, and on general sales. Well, you know, general property taxes are the most unliked taxes in the world. You know, people hate them, you know, because of evaluation problem and so forth. And general state taxes bring all the problems that Bartó elaborated. You know, they are inequitable, you know, and they may promote what we call Pareto efficiency, but Pareto efficiency, I have great doubts now. I don't know why we should praise a principle that leaves people poor, but not poorer, and make a few people extremely rich and even richer. So that I found that the literature really very strange, you know, and the basic message, I don't know whether it's a question of a message, is that we economists should be paying much less attention to equity and much more to efficiency and much more to equity, you know, to conclude, for example, the Scandinavian countries, which have done have a very high level of taxation, a very high level of social spending and so forth. If you look at a series of indices, you know, growth, individual liberty, labor participation, and so on, they score always at the top. And this has become really a surprise to me because, you know, some years back, I wrote a book 20 years ago with Ludger Schuchner, in which we said, well, the level of taxation should never exceed 35%, otherwise it creates lots of problems. You know, now I begin to have some doubts about that. If the spending is well done, and if there are not too many termites of the states, the theme of one of my recent books, you know, then you can have a high taxation. You know, to conclude, during the Second World War, the marginal tax rate in the U.S. was 94%. In the 60s and 70s, went to 71%. That was the time when the country was growing very fast. But then we brought it down to 28% during the Reagan time, and a little bit higher after that. And there was no impact on growth. So all this nonsense we have been writing about the connection between the growth and taxation, you know, about the efficiency. And I'm surprised that, you know, one time I saw a quotation from Lucas saying that economists should never waste any time talking about equity. You know, that is not our problem. You know, and it's, you know, brushing away the objective of equity. Anyway, maybe I've talked too long. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Vito. either raise your hand or just unmute if you'd like to ask a question. Okay, let's, there must be somebody who wants to ask a question. It's always getting the first few people to ask. But let me just, when Peter is talking, let me just ask one specific question and then we can have a first round of responses from you, Partho. So I guess going back to what Vito was saying, which a little bit was the sort of spirit of what was happening in India, is whether one should be thinking much more about what are the best instruments for equity rather than the best instruments for efficiency. And as you know, there's a lot of new thinking on that, you know, big push, giving people who are going into the labor market, you know, endowments of stuff to take into account of the fact that they come from different wealth backgrounds and so forth. But maybe if you could just comment on that and respond to what you've heard so far, and then we'll go back to another round of questions.
Okay. Well, using India, since you mentioned India as an example, I think there are many avenues that can achieve better equity through traditional tax instruments. For example, India's highest marginal income tax rate is 30%, and there is a surcharge on it. So it is about, let's say, 33% or less than that. Now, this rate at the highest rate is among the lowest in the world today, other than tax havens, other than Hong Kong and situations like that. And Hong Kong may change very soon. So why? The threat has always been that of capital flight and professional labor flight, that they will go to Singapore and so on and so forth. Well, that is not very easy to do to begin with. As I say, there are 1.3 billion Indians, and people are not waiting to open up their gates for Indians to come in, except probably the multi-billionaires. But so why not? And the fact is that this 30% is lower when India's, when you compare with countries such as Germany, UK, of course, and so on and so forth. In real terms, India's tax rate is much lower than these countries that are of a much higher per capita income and can afford much more social socioeconomic infrastructure by themselves. Still, the government takes much more from them. So in India, I think there is a built-in problem with the current progressive income tax structure for various arguments such as that, and government after government has succumbed to this argument. The second one is that on dividends, which for a long time, India had a special low tax rate on dividends because of the fear of various things. There's double taxation, we have to give more encouragement of capital. India has finally begun to equate dividend income tax with that of the general tax rates. Third, if you really look at capital gains tax, again, India gives a lot of lower rate and lower incentives. Then the other main argument against income taxation in India is that the individuals, even in the upper income groups, have to support and finance their own socioeconomic expenditures, which again is a big exaggeration, because that is done even by the very low income groups. If they are they fall sick or have severe health crisis at home, they have to spend the same money So isn't it therefore rational to tax and see some income redistribution program that will support the health of everyone? And therefore, one after the other, when you look at, and these are just the traditional means. Over and above that, of course, there is, because of the tax administration difficulty, or I would say opacity or whatever, there is a belief to be a huge amount of underground economy in India, and a lot of the tax unpaid amounts lurk in the tax havens in the rest of the world. And this is very well known. And despite promises by various governments, no government has been able to really take care of this. And the final point I want to make is, in India, not a single person that I know of has gone to jail for tax evasion up to today, even though India is one of the most tax evasive countries in the world. Whereas in the US, I remember even when the senior president Bush was president, he had to appear in court dragged by the IRS in the US. So there are many traditional instruments that India can employ in order to reduce tax evasion, up the tax contribution, revenue contribution, whether or not there is willingness by taxpayers, because the willingness of upper income groups among taxpayers is also very low in India, and that has to be corrected. If, since it has not worked for by voluntary means, it has to work under compulsion. That's what I feel.
Thank you very much, Parthas. I see a hand raised by Martin.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for everyone for the remarks. I just wanted to ask you, Partho, I think building a bit on what you've just said, you talked quite a bit about the recent negotiations that have been over the global minimum tax and the taxation of digital firms and so on. And one thing we know is that India has been a very, very active participant in these negotiations, been very willing to lead coalitions of developing countries in putting forward quite radical positions. And yet at the end of the day, the outcome doesn't really reflect much of what India wanted, and India has nonetheless signed up to it. So I was wondering what you think, based on all the analysis you've got of the history and the law and the administration, and I guess also the politics, what do you think drives India's engagement with other countries when it comes to international taxation?
That's a very good question, Martin. If one sees, when I was in the ministry, I must say that even at that time, there was a huge reticence on Indian government's part to even think in the direction of the OECD, because it was believed to be a rich man's club. And it took a lot of persuasion, frankly, on my part to allow, from the minister's point of view, Indian bureaucrats, technocrats in the tax area to participate in the deliberations of the whole G20's base erosion and profit shifting of multinational enterprise project, or BEPS. And even before that, India started sending tax officials as observers. Now, the good thing that happened is that after some initial hurdles, very good and able Indian tax officials were representing India in the OECD BEPS deliberations. And I believe that their quality participation drew the attention of OECD officials, and they very much look forward to their participation. Of course, some of them couldn't continue because of the bureaucratic promotion system and so on and so forth. They were withdrawn, some others were sent, who were also good. That was the good part. So the whole point is, the conviction took place that India, within India, that India should participate to the extent possible in these international deliberations. And even if India cannot get its way most of the time, still its presence is a good thing, as long as there is a small step forward. And those steps are occurring in the BEPS project. So India has been a signatory in the minimum corporate income tax. India has been a signatory, as it should be, because a country such as India, with its economic clout, whatever it is, it can go only up to a point. And that kind of practical recognition has been coming to India, thankfully, and hopefully it'll stay. Similarly, for example, in retrospective taxation, since the retrospective taxation law was passed in 2012, it has taken up to 2021 for the government to withdraw retrospective taxation, because the government time and again went back to the courts every time government lost a case with respect to the multinationals, even though, as I said, retrospective taxation makes it impossible to perform for these enterprises, whether they are domestic multinationals or foreign multinationals. So I think in various ways, India is showing in bits and drabs, but certainly in a visible way, that it is becoming more and more practical in the arena of international taxation and is participating in the deliberations, even though it may not always get exactly what it wants.
Thank you. Are there any other, we're sort of approaching the end of, we're 1 minute off the end of time. So I think probably we don't have time for another round of questions. But I just wanted to thank Partho and Ricardo for Partho for his book and his presentation, Ricardo for your comments, and most of all of you who have come from all over the world to listen. It's very nice to see Vito again, even though it's online. Because I think what Partho has sort of picked up on is now really at the center of interest within public finance, which is the concern with which Vito is also pointing to with inequity and how one corrects that. And I think it's a much bigger issue than obviously just public finance, because it determines the level of social cohesion within a country and so forth, which others are working on. But just from a very personal perspective, sitting as I am here in Stickard at the LSE, it's good to see that the young public economists such as Daniel Rack and Camille Lande and Johannes Spinnerman are really working on these issues in a way that was perhaps less present 5 or 10 years ago. So that at least on the academic side is very reassuring. And then on the policy side, the kind of interest in international redistribution that I saw in COP26, again, is a sign that people really are recognizing both the inequity that's out there, but also are thinking about how one, as Partho put it, practically deal with these issues and introduce instruments to correct them, which I think, again, on the policy side is very welcome. So I on the chat, there was a couple of questions about can people get hold of this? So it's all going to be released as a podcast by the International Inequality Institute at the LSE. So you can just go onto that website and see a full recording of the event if you want to refer back. And I'm sure Partho would be willing to share slides and so on. So without any, just to say again, thank you to Partho, thank you to Ricardo, and thank you to all of you for coming today. And nice to see some old people I haven't seen for some time. Thank you very much.